Yeah, when I posted this, I posted
like, hey, everybody, how you doing?
12:25.
Yeah. It is. Good evening, good morning, good afternoon, everybody. Today, we're going to talk about things that Penelope does in a world where the demand for mental health support is more urgent than ever. The unique needs of our first responders present a pretty challenging and pressing challenge. Our first responders face extraordinary situations daily, and they witness tragedies that take an enormous toll on their emotional well-being. Their experience call for pretty specialized care and understanding. So I'm honored to introduce Penelope Camerata as someone who stands at the forefront of this vital mission. Penelope is a 6.5-year veteran as an EMT in Philadelphia. Her journey through personal trauma led her to discover alternative therapy methods that are tailored specifically for first responders, veterans, and frontline workers. So through her business, Internal Consciousness, she provides a lifeline of emotional, mental, physical, and spiritual support using innovative techniques, I guess, and modalities like Reiki, Ayurvedic medicine, and sound healing. She's a therapeutic trauma life coach with a passion for healing. So like her experience, her wisdom, and expertise offer a beacon of hope for those who are dedicating their lives to helping others. And in just overall, she's an amazing person, and I'm glad to have her on the show. So let's learn more about her. Here we go. I am excited to have you here today, Penelope.
I'm excited to be here. I have been looking forward to this for like a week now.
Well, let's do this. I want to start back with an old tradition, new again. And who do you want to do a shout out to?
I want to do a shout out to any veteran, active or retired, and any first responder, active or retired, that you guys are great. And thank you for serving. And I am proud to be one of you.
I cannot wait to learn more about this because, you know, I think a lot of times, not as much recently, but a lot of times people look at first responders and they're like, yes, they are heroes. They're the ones that jump in there and get things done. And they sometimes can think about them as like almost like TV characters. Yes, I put out some fires today and let's go to the movies tonight.
Yeah. There's yeah. That.
Yeah, there is. We're going to talk about that. So tell me about like when you decided that you needed to seek help, because you are one of those first responders. And like, what did you do yourself? What took you to therapy and helping yourself mentally?
Oh, wow. What took me to therapy was 10 days prior to me graduating from EMT school 6.5 years ago. A friend of mine who was a lieutenant with the Philadelphia Police Department took his own life. And unfortunately, I didn't know about it until literally the day before I was to take my exit exams for the EMT at the state level. And I literally was in shock. I didn't know how to process it. I've been around, you know, my mom being sick, my raising a diabetic daughter, my uncle being an EMT and a sheriff. Always being around law enforcement and EMS, I've always kind of dealt with that, but nothing that hit that personal, that close to home, literally in the same zip code as where I've been at. When my mom passed away when I was 21, it hit me, but it hit me as a maternal thing versus... because I knew she had been suffering from diabetes for a long time. So I knew that it was a different set of circumstances. And with his death, it was a sudden thing. It was unexpected. It took literally almost the entire department of almost 6,000 officers by surprise, because he'd been close to a 30-year veteran with the Philadelphia Police Department. So him doing something like that was a big, huge thing. And how he did it was another, because he'd been on SWAT. He had a master's degree from Temple University. He was one of the top training officers out there. He he built his life around being a cop. Mm-hmm. And he was an arms expert. He was their sniper. He tested equipment for gun companies on their accessories to make sure that they were correct and accurate and they worked correctly. He had his own collection. So him taking his own life by prescription medications was a big hit because that was totally not him. He was the ultimate Italian America Goomba.
Right.
His family actually has history in Philadelphia back in the 80s with Chicken Man Testa. That was a relative of his. So there's uh-huh. actually a lot of history in Philadelphia for this man. And proud Sicilians don't do what he did. Right. And I'm trying to process this. And I was married to a poor Sicilian. So I'm trying to process all this. And I've got this state test to do. And I'm like, I got to get through this. I can't deal with anything else right now. I was in tears during my entire state test. And bless the proctor's hearts. They were very understanding and they didn't push. They didn't ask. And they worked with me on it. And I got through it and I passed, but I was a hot mess. And I dove right into being an EMT. I worked every overtime shift I could. To me, that was normal, was working 60, 70 hours a week. I've always worked two jobs. So I put all my hours into one job instead. And finally, it got to the point where about a year into it, I started getting, I don't know, you want to call it disillusioned or disheartened, but it was, I guess it was everyone's attitudes in EMS that this is I'm not getting paid enough. You know, they're whining about hours. They're whining about the job. They're whining about this, that, and the other. And I'm like, and I'm the most easygoing person around, or I used to be.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden it's just, I'm looking at them like, grow a pair.
Did it affect the rest of the department? Like you, did you guys ever stop and talk about it?
No, it was like, you need to take some days off, you know, go do something. And it's like, yeah, you got me on the schedule for 7 days straight. Really? Yeah. Seriously? I'll take a day off at that point. And it never happened because it got pushed back into the back of the mind. Other things came forward, you know, responsibilities. And it was, I worked in an environment where that was not a thing that you talked about because it wasn't that big of an issue to them.
Wait, you're saying that someone taking their own life who's been on the force for 30 years was not a big issue to them?
No. Talking about it wasn't a big issue. I should have moved on by now because it was just a friend. Unfortunately, this was a very close friend of mine. And I took it. I didn't really take it personally, but I internalized it and I put it into that personal space. And no one encouraged me to talk about what was going on, and I closed myself.
Okay. Was there?
I wanted to talk about it, but there was no one to talk to about.
That was what I want to ask. So there's not an internal therapy department or a psychologist, psychiatrist, any kind of help like that for you?
Not where when I started working with the ambulance, there was nothing like that. Private ambulance companies don't have anything like that. That's not heard of. Because it's transport, they figure, oh, you're just doing discharges. There's no stress involved. Oh, yeah, okay, whatever. I'm not going to go there. you learn real fast that EMS, and I've always had the mindset that an emergency can happen at any time.
Right.
Whether you're getting just because you got discharged from the hospital doesn't mean that you can have another medical emergency going home. Or as soon as you get home, you have another medical emergency. That's maybe something different. Emergencies happen all the time. That's why they call it an emergency.
Mm-hmm.
It's sudden. And just because you're scheduling a transport to take someone home does not mean anything. It's basically you're taking someone home. That's it. Because they can't ride in a car. They have to go by stretcher. Okay. Oh. doesn't mean that emergencies can't happen. You still have to be on your toes.
Talk about this. I mentioned this in the green room before we started the show, and a little bit during the intro of you. But the most that people see about emergencies and, you know, police and everything is on TV, and you see the guys rolling people up on the stretchers. It's like, whew, that's good. Let's go have a beer. And then what's the difference between TV and reality?
Oh, bless TV's heart. They have it right to a point. You know, a lot of times you do hang out with your coworkers because that's who you see the most. You have somewhat of a family dynamic inside your domain, your area where you work, whether it's fire, police, EMS, even dispatchers. You have a I hate the word click, but that's kind of what it is. I hate reverting back to high school, but a click is a good word for it, because they've seen you at your worst. They've had your back in an emergency. They know your life stories because you spend hours in a car with them, or a truck, or at the firehouse. You know, it's you spend a lot of time with these people. They become your second family, and they almost become, for some people, their primary family, based on family dynamics, whatever. But the thing is that it's not neat and tidy like it is on TV. It's messy. It's ugly.
What do you mean by that?
Emotional. It's your car accidents, your crime scenes. They're not tidy houses. They're dirty houses. They're rough neighborhoods. They're in medical calls. You know, you very rarely ever see an ambulance company take out somebody on a stretcher that's 250 pounds with two people and no backup. You know, you always see them, you know, you never actually see them lift that person onto the stretcher. You always see them, the person's on the stretcher and they're wheeling the stretcher to the ambulance.
Right. Come getting on, them people. Off the ground is a different story, right?
Different story. Going in, walking into a pile of human feces, human waste, dirty apartment, blood everywhere. Who knows what kind of a scenario you've got? You've got down in a part of Philadelphia, you've got Drug City, where there's needles everywhere, there's paraphernalia everywhere, there's people everywhere laying on the streets. It's not glamorous. It is not cut and dried. It's not black and white. It is very gray. It is so gray. It's muddy. A lot of the police shows, you know, I've never seen a cleaner interrogation room than on a police show.
Right.
I'll tell you that. Okay. It's like, wow, really? Because there's police departments that have, when it rains, they have leaks in their locker room and they have standing water on the ground that they have to walk through to get to their lockers because they have no drain system, because it's a super old building and they don't want to update it.
Right.
Police departments are not clean. I did do a walkthrough through a police department at one time, one of the districts here in Philly, and it wasn't bad, but it's very dull, very boring, very quiet. It's very strict on how their protocols are. You don't ever walk, like, okay, let's take CSI Miami. You don't ever walk into a police department with handcuffed. This is a suspect handcuffed who has a knife in his pocket still. Uh-huh. Not going to happen in real life. It is not going to happen in real life. I can tell you that right now. And these are the best dressed detectives and police officers ever that don't look like slobs.
Yes.
In real life, there's some questions as to how a cop should look. And it should be addressed as their policy that they should look better. They should look more professional. But they're never going to look as good as what's on TV. I'll tell you that.
All right.
it's not black and white. It's not the same.
There's something I have to ask you about, because and since we're talking about the TV, is everybody's rough and tough, and they've seen people get shot every day, and there's, it's like, eh, that's nothing. I got to shoot him, and I'm going to put my gun away and go back to work the next day. Or if with the EMT, you know, people die in real life and on TV, but on TV, it's like, yep, there's another one. That's the trauma I want to talk about that people see every day. And how in real life, how does that trauma hit you? And what, and do you just brush it off, or is it, you get used to it? Tell me about it. What happens?
I think it's a little bit of everything. At first you can brush it off. It also depends on the trauma, because we don't know what our, we carry five generations of traumatic DNA in our DNA system as a person. Okay. So whatever happened to our ancestors five generations ago has actually been brought forward, and we carry that DNA. We don't know what's in that DNA. We don't know what could possibly trigger us at all. A good example is when I first volunteered at Springfield Ambulance Company in Delaware County, my first call on night shift was a burned car with a burned victim inside. And my entire reaction to it, I stood there and had no emotions at all. I didn't cry. I didn't get upset. I didn't start hyperventilating. I didn't start freaking out and babbling. I literally like, oh, okay. The state trooper walks over to me and says, you guys need to pronounce. And I'm like, let me go find out if we can do that or not. Because we can to a point, but there's under certain protocols. And so the EMT that I was precepting with, she said, no, we don't do it. Let make the medic do it. You know, and then he went and told the medic, and the medic's like, no, medical examiner's on its way. We already know he's dead, but the medical examiner can come out, and when he comes out and get the body, he can pronounce it. It's called paperwork. I had no idea that
there was like politics to death. You're not really dead.
Oh, yeah. It's, we have a, in Pennsylvania, EMTs have a protocol where we can pronounce if it's an obvious death, if there's obvious rigor mortis, if it's an obvious burn victim in a burned car, we know that's like, there's no way to recognize them. Yeah, we can pronounce that, but the paperwork behind it is horrendous. So we push it off to the medics, and 9 times out of 10, they push it off to the medical examiner and tell them to deal with it, because they got to pick up the body anyway. It's just, we don't want to deal with the paperwork, because there's other things going on behind the scenes with that paperwork that we don't want to deal with.
Let me ask you a question, though. You were there. This is your first case, I guess. And you said you
first 911 case.
Okay. This is your first one out of the gate. And you were...
First one out of the gate, yeah.
Okay. So you've got someone who's burned up in a car. They're dead. It's not something you see every day. Maybe they show you these things in EMT school. I don't know.
Oh, yeah. But, yeah. They show videos and stuff like that.
Okay. So this is your first live time. How did you feel after you... experienced this whole situation?
Well, luckily I knew how to do Reiki and breath work, because 12 hours later is when it hit me as to what I walked into with into that scene. And it's like, oh my God. And then when I actually got more information about it, I wish I had never gotten more information about it, because that changed my perception of the incident as well. Okay. And it may trigger people who's watching this, and I apologize. What happened was that I found out that the person had been alive in the vehicle when it caught on fire and he burned to death alive. Mm-hmm. And a cop tried to bust out the windshield to get him out and could not. So it not only affected and impacted that cop especially, but it also impacted all those drivers that were there on that freeway that seen the accident and were almost in as part of that accident, that watched it happen.
Right.
And then I get, and then when you get EMS personnel and firefighters on the scene and they find out this guy was alive and got burned alive, that has an impact on now me. And then I get to take that home. And, you know, luckily I don't have anybody I can dump this onto at home, because when I got home 12 hours later, I was a wreck because I kept thinking about that information. It was like a Ferris wheel in my head, just rolling around in there and not stopping. Right. And the only thing that got me through it was the techniques I learned through pulling myself out of my own depression of the Reiki and the breath work and listening to certain types of music that calmed me down, and smells. Right. Smells are a big thing. It works.
You know what's interesting here, and you just brought this up. I didn't think about it. You're talking about it from your point of view, and you were the one, you're processing your own stuff. But you're right. There's the people driving by. There's the people standing around. They're all affected by this accident and by the death. And it makes it even more important, I think, that you have now gotten to a place where you're helping other people work through these traumas. Because I certainly don't know how I would handle it, you know. But when did you start like working with other people, knowing that they needed help? They couldn't just like go home for a week and come back and be okay. That it's extraordinary.
I actually started doing that after I got my Reiki master teacher certification, because I wanted to focus on working with first responders through Reiki. And shifting energies and working with mindfulness by getting the person into that state of mindfulness. And mm-hmm. and through that is through relaxation and through just a calm setting, because we have so much chaos going on around us that we need to find some place where we can de-stress, we can drop our guard and walk into an environment that's calm, peaceful. There's no stress or very little stress that you're not going to pick up on, but that you can also be yourself without communicating. That's the best part. With Reiki, you don't have to communicate. It can be a total silence. It can be aromatherapy can be integrated into it, because smells can trigger things, but they can also release stress. Smells set the mood for what we have, like coffee fanatics. The smell of a favorite brewed coffee is like very soothing, because it brings up memories of good times, of good accomplishments, of things that you want to get done. It sets your frame of mind and your mood to go mm-hmm. through the day. It's not about the caffeine. It's okay. Not all about the caffeine anyway. We still got to have that caffeine, but people like will get like the Highlander's grog, which has a caramel flavor to it. And the smell, oh my gosh, the smell is phenomenal. And when it's hot, it's great. And when it's cold, or room temperature, it's still a great coffee. But the smell.
It must be. I can tell just from your body language.
It's just, it was so awesome to drink that cup of coffee. I thoroughly enjoyed that coffee. And it's like, I got to find out where that stuff's made, because I want more of it.
There we go.
It was an experience that put me into a better frame of mind, that gave me pleasant memories of my long hours of traveling with Greyhound. It made it more pleasurable. It made it bearable. And sounds can do the same thing. So anytime you have someone that's stressed out, the first thing you want to do is you want to get them into a calm environment. And I can tell you right now, a bar is not calm. Neither a bar is not the best environment. I'm just going to say it straight up. A bar is not a great place to decompress. A restaurant is not a great place to decompress. You need to have some place where you can kind of have a safe haven, where you can go into your little cocoon and you can go in there as a moth and come, you know, go in there as a caterpillar and come out as a butterfly again.
I got to ask you this, because we've been so programmed because of TV. It's like all the great things happen in bars.
And exactly.
Right. Like, what is it? Is there a culture, or is there a mindset that, you know, the boss has, whoever that chief is, that like, okay, these guys need to suck it up and get back on the job. And if you take time off for mental health, you're weak and we're not going to put up with that. Or is it more accepted now? And how do people feel like coming to someone who's a therapist like you and like having to bare their soul? I'm sure at some point people break down and cry.
Oh, yes.
What's it like? What do people want to get that off their chest? Are they afraid to do it? Tell us.
They're terrified to get it off their chest, because then they see themselves as weak. They've been raised through the male dominance that it's weakness for a man. It's wrong for a man to show weakness, first of all. Second of all, I just did an article for The Price of Business with Kevin Price about the stigmas of female first responders and veterans in a male-dominated career, where the good old boys have had stigmas for years of it's a man's job. We're going to have to drop our requirements down to get more women in. Our level of standards is going to be decreased. We're going to look like pansies if we have to help a female firefighter out. Well, she's your partner. Yeah, you're going to help her out. You better, because you're all a team. Even though a lot of these old timers, and I'm going to call them old timers, a lot of these old timers have either passed on or they've gone higher up the hierarchy and now sit behind a desk, those stigmas have not gone away. They have stayed in place. They've decreased some, especially where you're in like, well, I really can't even say like even in a big city where you have a lot more females in the male dominant careers, because a lot of times you may have a platoon at one ladder company out of the entire ladder ambulance. And maybe if there's a foam truck there, you may have one or two women the entire shift for a 12-hour shift. And those are two 4 days on, 4 day off rotations here in Philly.
Okay.
So you're one of maybe two women on a shift, or one on a shift with a bunch of men. I mean, that's really not raising the bar that, yeah, you want more women in the profession, but they want them on the ambulance. They don't want them on the fire truck, because there's a lot more carrying. It's heavier work. It's harder work. And I totally agree. But if a woman can pass that test, and I've seen their physical ability test, and yeah, it's geared for age and weight and height. But that's for men and women. Okay. So if she qualifies for that weight and that height, and she passes the fire academy, what's the problem?
Right.
Yeah. There shouldn't be a problem. And
I'm sure there's no outward bigotry or anything against women, or is
it
there?
Subtle? It's subtle, and it's not necessarily bigotry, but it is. How do I put this politely?
I don't know.
It's more like high school all over again. It's the talking behind the back. Men are bigger gossips than women, I can tell you right now, in these professions. There's the sexual innuendos, there's the trash talk between guys, and if a woman walks by and she has to hear it, they don't change their attitude. They don't talk about that stuff privately or not at all. Their view is that, well, you know, she works in the fire department, she better get used to it because she's working in a man's job, and if she's offended, she can just quit.
And does that same thing happen in the EMT world, or is it mostly in the police or fire?
Not as much. Like mostly it's in fire for that and police. In EMS, it's more like they whine and snivel to each other, and then they go to the supervisor and complain that somebody can't lift a patient and that, you know, their back hurts because their part female partner can't lift.
Uh-huh.
And usually they're the ones that get stuck driving the most.
Now, get stuck driving. That's interesting. Like everyone growing up wants to like drive the fire truck. You're saying that's the part people don't want to do.
They don't want to drive the ambulance. They're not just an ambulance driver.
Oh, I see. Because the ambulance driver stays in this ambulance. They don't get out and do things.
They do, but they don't do patient care or as much. They're supposed to be very set roles for each person for it to run smoothly. I've yet to see that in Philadelphia run smoothly. I've seen it run more smoothly out in Delaware. Literally, my driver, I would be the primary with crew chief, whatever you want to call it. I'd have my driver who was driving that day. And it was that we had several without really knowing, in stone what they were, the driver's required to do this, primary's required to do that. But it was like we knew what each other was supposed to do without saying it. We didn't have to have it written down. We didn't have to have it mandated. It was just how it was taught to us. And it worked very smooth. Gotcha. It was great.
Go back to therapy for a second now I'm seeing all kinds of, I guess, opportunities for therapy. You've got the discrimination therapy that goes on. You've got the trauma from different accidents. You've got everyday life therapy. What is it that you see most of, and where do people need the most, I guess, help?
Where I've seen it is people that need help with triggers.
Give me an example of a trigger.
I had a veteran get a hold of me, and he was out of the military 5-6 years, very struggling in civilian life, didn't really know what to do, almost like going through an identity crisis type thing, because he didn't know he fit in. You know, you have such a structure in the military. They give you 30 days to prepare to leave, but they don't really give you much. They give you a packet of information and say, have a nice life. You know, it's not preparing you that, you know, you're making your own decisions now. You're responsible for your own stuff. You have to think for yourself. And he was struggling with that. But a lot of his came down to because he went into the military to get away from childhood traumas. Mm-hmm. So I ended up having to work with him on going and dealing with that childhood trauma that was the start of everything. Because once you have one, it seems to snowball. And then you have to deal with the next. If you don't address the you can't heal the wound. So if you only heal the top part, the wound underneath is still festering. So it's never going to heal. What I did was I took him back into his childhood, his earliest childhood trauma that he could remember. And I walked him through as the third person's perspective as to how it all laid out, what happened, and then you can change the ending of your own story a bit. Because once you change the ending of that story and you have a connection to that, you can go back and safely work through everything that affected you in your childhood, clear up into the day before. But it's a process, and it's not like it's going to happen overnight. But the great thing is that I can give him the tools, and then he took it from there to where I didn't have to walk him through every single one. He had learned the skill to be able to do it himself and could take it on his own and do it on his own. And it took like two sessions with him to get through it. And within a month, he was doing it on his own and was confident enough to work through it. because he had, I had helped him create a safety net, basically. And looking at something from a third perspective.
That's what you do with everybody, right?
Changes things.
Yeah.
That's what I try to do with everybody. And that seems to be, no matter what the problem is now, I help him go back to the root of the problem to find out the cause. Because once you find the cause and you can change the ending to that story, you can change other things. And that also helps you change that bi-generational trauma DNA.
Yeah. I love that whole story. I hope that came through okay, because you're breaking up on my side, but hopefully through the cloud, people could actually hear what was going on. I caught most of it and I'm liking what I'm hearing.
Okay.
Just so I want people to learn a little bit more about you. And I play this game with everyone called This or That. And we're going to do that right now. I'm going to give you two choices. You can choose one or the other, but you can't choose neither or both. So these questions start out easy. They get maybe a little more hard. And at the end, we get more thought provoking. So let's learn some more about Penelope Camerata and see what's going on in that mind that you have. I avoid this question for almost everybody, but I'm going to ask you the easiest question ever. And it's because it's about relaxation. So for you, coffee or tea? You're the first person I've asked that question.
Tea.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
As much as you love that, the one with the caramel and everything in it, you're going to go with tea. I love that. Okay. Mm-hmm. When you need to recharge. Okay, go ahead.
No, I just said tea, definitely.
Okay. So when you need to recharge, do you prefer city living or countryside retreat?
Oh, God. Countryside retreat.
Okay. How about Reiki or sound healing? Because you do both.
Reiki.
Okay. You said you don't have to be there for Reiki, which is good for a lot of people, I'm guessing.
Oh. Definitely.
Okay. Journaling or meditation?
Journaling.
Okay. Well, when working with first responders, okay, solo practice or group therapy?
Solo.
Are any of the first responders kind of up for the group therapy, or is it just too much?
Not that I've seen yet, because they like the safety of the anonymity. But I'm actually working on doing some online group therapy where the requirement is they have to have their cameras off.
Okay. Okay.
So they can still participate in group therapy, but still have that confidentiality and anonymity until they feel safe. It's safe enough to turn on their camera for people to see them.
Gotcha. How about for physical well-being, yoga or cardio?
Cardio.
Okay. What do you like to do?
A kettlebell. It's easy and I can get through a set and I can stop. And actually, kettlebell workouts are better for you than free weights for weight distribution. And also, kettlebells have a unique thing that because of the muscles you use in your body, you actually continue to burn fat after you stop working out. So you don't have to work out as kettlebells as you do free weights.
I had a guest on once and we talked about kettlebells and they're just fascinating to me. And of course, my lazy butt has not gone out and actually got my kettlebells yet. The best I can do right now is my little bands, my stretchy bands, which work for me.
You have to use one 5-pound kettlebell. That's all you need. You don't need two. You can start with one.
I can swing it above my head. Ooh, okay.
Oh, I wouldn't do that.
No, I wouldn't do it either. What's been more challenging for you, healing others or your own self-healing?
Healing myself.
Oh, okay. Why?
We are our own worst enemy when it comes to judgments, criticisms, acknowledging our own faults. Mm-hmm. And accepting that who we are is not a bad thing. It doesn't make us a bad person. Being comfortable in your own skin is tough. Society has so many rules and expectations that if you're not comfortable with yourself in any of the four areas, you're always going to be looking at yourself as being, well, people like to use the term broken, but it's totally incorrect. We're not broken. We're wounded. And the reason why it's mislabeled is because wounds can heal, be healed. There is nothing about us that cannot be healed. So that we are not broken like Humpty Dumpty. We just have a wound that needs treatment and we can heal and move on with our lives.
Gotcha.
We may carry scars, but that's what life's about.
Yeah. Let me ask you about mental health again, care for first responders. Do you think the focus should be more on prevention or treatment?
Definitely prevention.
Yeah. How is that going to be taught in schools, or is that going to be taught once they get on the job, or where's that going to be? Where's the focus for that going to come from, you think?
Well, I mean, a lot of instructor certification, like EMT instructor, first aid instructor, instructor. And the great thing about being an instructor for those classes is that I can implement that into the teaching myself. You know, I can slip that in, that little mental health awareness in during a quick session, just as like, you know, and here's a side note, it's kind of a sneaky way to do it because in EMT school, you have a psych chapter. So we have a lot of psych patients. So mental health can be a medical emergency. It can be slipped in there. When I teach TIM, which is basically roadside emergency care on positioning vehicles, how to train first responders and tow truck drivers, dispatchers, how to respond to and the process of when an accident occurs on a highway or a freeway, how it works on getting cleaned up, how it works on getting cleared away, what's the proper lanes, that sort of thing. It has more to do with Department of Transportation than it does emergency vehicle operation.
You just said something I didn't even think about this. We talked about, you know, the firemen, policemen, the ambulance drivers, people driving by. Tow truck drivers have to deal with this. I mean, I didn't even think about that. It's like you got to deal with the blood, the everything else.
The car wrecks, the smashed glass, you know, if there's someone's being extricated out. Yesterday, I did my TIM training, and I had triggers from that TIM training, from that burn victim that was in that car crash that I first experienced. I was having triggers yesterday during a 4.5-hour class with this Department of Transportation thing, and I was like flipping out during our breaks. And I was so happy for the breaks because I was literally having to shove aromatherapy probably up my nose just to calm down because I was stressing out just from watching some of the video crashes. It was just like I was just not having a good day with it.
Let me ask you one last question.
I totally zoned out.
What speaks to you more, in overall, a life of ease or a life of profound meaning?
Meaning speaks to me more.
What do you want people to know? People have been watching this, people popping in and out. You've got this is my 100,000 people in a stadium question. You've got the only microphone and they have to hear what you're saying. What is it that you want people to walk away with? And you talk into that microphone and it goes into their minds. What do you want them to learn from you?
The best thing I want them to learn from me is that I have a phone. I have email. I have a website and they can contact me at any time. And I am here to listen, because that is the best thing that a therapeutic life coach can do and should do, is be an active listener. Yeah. I can give you example after example of different cases of traumas and the outcomes. And the one thing I can't give you are exact numbers of success rates, because everybody is different. Everybody's going to walk away with a different take on what they go through. And to me, when I have clients, it's not a therapy session. It's not like it's being documented for anybody else. It is not recorded unless they want a recording of it for their own personal use. I very rarely take notes. I'm horrible at that, but I do that because I want to have my attention focused on them, and taking notes, doing other stuff is not productive. And I have this thing where I don't have to meet them in person. I have an internet where I can meet them. I do not have to meet them face to face in a room. If their safe haven is a walk-in closet in their bedroom where they feel safe and they can decompress and that's where they want to talk to me, by all means, have
at it. You've got a very interesting life, I want you to know. I want people to be able to stay in touch with you for sure, because I think what you're doing is super important. For everyone that's listening and can't see the URL that's on the screen, the website is internal-consciousness. I'll let you look up how to spell consciousness. dot.
And it's spelled it's correctly.
No, not you. I'm talking about people listening. So internal-consciousness. dot. And it's the next thing is UniWeb, but it's spelled U-E-N-I web. However you say that. UeniWeb, web.com. So that's a tough one. Easier is Facebook and Instagram, because it's just at internal consciousness. So that's the best way to get in touch with Penelope, or one of the ways. It's easy. Yes. And I love what we've been talking about. I'm going to leave that on the screen as we bounce out of here so people can write it down or look it up right now. And this has been a fascinating conversation. Seriously, I love what you're doing. So thank you for that.
One thing I wanted to add to your TV question about TV and real life, there is one thing that actually connects TV and real life to first responders and military, even, is that what people don't realize with actors and actresses, and what they don't realize, is that when they portray those roles in movies, they develop trauma themselves, because they are so ingrained into their roles. They sometimes become that person or that profession or that, they embrace that role to where it becomes them. And they can actually develop trauma from the roles they play. Heath Ledger had that problem.
I will tell you that you today have opened my mind. And I'm aware of mental health and issues and people need to take care of it. But this specific examples of the people who deal with trauma every day is like, it's been mind opening today. And even now you're talking about the actors and actresses, that's profound. I didn't understand. I didn't realize that. So thank you. Okay.
Trauma doesn't have a, like a plop effect in like the mud. It definitely carries as the rock that skips across the pond. It has ripples, it causes ripples, and those ripples can be long-reaching. It's what we do with those ripples and how we react to them is what stops mm-hmm. those ripples from occurring more.
Gotcha. Thank you for being on. I really appreciate you.
Well, thank you for having me.
Everybody, we'll see you on the next show. And peace out, everyone. Bye-bye.